content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. Well, friends, it's been quite a few weeks since I've recorded a new program. There certainly has been a lot of news in the meantime. I will simply say that I hope you all are doing well, and I'm glad to be back. We're reading this week from the May 22nd, 2020 issue of The Week magazine. The cover drawing this week shows Uncle Sam. He's free-falling upside down in a clear blue sky. He does have a parachute attached to him, but the strings are not taut, and it looks like there's a hole in the parachute. His hat's flying off, and he's got a startled look in his eyes. And the title is Free Fall. Is the U.S. economy headed for a second Great Depression? And in fact, that is our first main story, and we'll start right there. Historic job losses in a crippled economy. What happened? The U.S. unemployment rate soared to levels not seen since the Great Depression, as the total number of jobs lost since government-ordered shutdowns began in March surpassed 33 million last week. Officially, the Labor Department puts the jobless rate at 14.7%, but that doesn't include jobs lost in the last 2 weeks of April. And Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin conceded the real rate might actually be as high as 25%. In all, about 1 in 5 Americans have lost their jobs, and another 6.5 million have been scaled back to part-time. The biggest losses were among low-wage earners, Hispanics, blacks, and women. President Trump predicted those jobs will all be back very soon. And the Bureau of Labor Statistics reported that 78% of unemployed workers viewed their layoffs as temporary. But Diane Swonk, chief economist at Grant Thornton, warned that with no end to the pandemic in sight, these furloughs are permanent. President Trump contended that all throughout the country, infection rates were coming down rapidly on the same day that NBC News obtained a leaked White House document showing a surge in cases in 10 mostly heartland counties, including spikes of 1,000+% in 2 counties in Tennessee and Kansas. As more than 40 states reopened their economies, Trump cheered them on, even though only 23 had met the benchmark of 2 weeks decline in new cases as stipulated by his administration. In Senate testimony, the White House's chief infectious disease specialist, Dr. Anthony Fauci, warned that Americans are risking needless suffering and death and a major new wave of infections by reopening too early. This could even set you back on the road to trying to get economic recovery, he said. What the editorials said. For heaven's sake, reopen the economy, said Wall Street Journal. All around us, the economic destruction is evident as businesses declare bankruptcy and workers transition from furloughed to the unemployment line. Only 51.3% of adults now have a job, the lowest percentage on record. We can't wait for a vaccine, so we have to learn to live with the virus by enacting such sensible strategies as widespread testing, distributing protective equipment, and continuing the lockdown for societies most vulnerable. States that are reopening their economies without adequate testing are making an epic gamble with the lives of residents, said the Washington Post. They have little to no idea of the pandemic's dimensions, and many are still recording statewide daily infectious counts that are either rising, Missouri, have plateaued, Texas, or have barely declined in more than a month, South Carolina. As people return to work and commerce, there is a terrible risk that this trial and error approach will result in a spike in infections and deaths. What the columnist said. With 1.4 million confirmed cases in the U.S., 84,000 deaths, and the economy in free fall, Trump has no plan, said David Graham in TheAtlantic.com. Instead, this week, he declared mission accomplished and urged governors to reopen and hope for the best. Trump has even reverted to saying the virus will go away without a vaccine. His aides say he is shell-shocked by his declining popularity. Obviously, the president is overmatched by the coronavirus, which won't yield to showmanship, bullying, or tweeted insults. Anyone who still thinks the pain has been limited to restaurant and travel workers is very much mistaken, said Neil Irwin in the New York Times. The jobs report revealed losses in many industries. Yes, leisure and hospitality sloughed a remarkable 7.7 million workers, or almost half of the total. But the healthcare industry also shed 1.4 million employees as physician and dental offices shuttered. Even 2.2 million white-collar jobs were lost. In an imploding economy, we're all vulnerable. Very soon, you and I will have to figure out how to navigate a semi-open America where coronavirus is a terrible fact of life, said Matthew Continetti in freebeacon.com. South Korea, New Zealand, and Taiwan have gotten the virus under control, but America's sheer size and tradition of individual liberty make it unlikely we can mount an effective test, trace, and isolate program needed for a smart reopening. A dumb reopening with periodic flare-ups in infections and 1,700 or more Americans dying every day is what lies ahead, whether we like it or not. And we'll go right into the second main story. COVID-19 arrives at the White House. What happened? The Trump administration was scrambling this week to contain a potential coronavirus outbreak within the White House after aides to President Trump and Vice President Mike Pence tested positive for the disease. Katie Miller, Pence's press secretary and the wife of senior policy advisor Stephen Miller, quarantined herself last week after discovering she was infected. Just days earlier, one of the personal valets who served the president food and drink also tested positive. Three key members of the Coronavirus Task Force, Centers for Disease Control Director Robert Redfield, FDA Commissioner Stephen Hahn, and Anthony Fauci, head of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, all went into voluntary quarantine after having contact with infected staffers. The cases triggered panic in the West Wing, where employees work in close quarters and cramped spaces, and many, including Trump and Pence, have ignored federal workplace guidelines by neglecting to wear masks or observe social distancing. As the task force officials quarantined, others who'd had contact with the infected pair continued to come to work, raising questions about whether the president's inner circle is being adequately protected. As of this week, all White House staff are expected to wear masks inside the building. Trump is exempt from the rule, and to work at home as much as possible. Most West Wing staffers are now also being tested daily. Still, anxiety runs high. It is scary to go to work, said economic advisor Kevin Hassett. I think that I'd be a lot safer if I was sitting at home than I would be going to the West Wing. What the columnist said. The new White House policies underscore an important point, said the Washington Post in an editorial. Officials know what needs to be done for themselves, diagnostic testing, contact tracing, and isolating, but Trump has failed in his duty to provide it for the country. Right now, states are conducting about 300,000 tests a day, about a tenth of the total required to safely reopen workplaces. until everyone in the country has access to the kind of rapid testing belatedly deployed in the White House, the virus will continue to spread and kill. That's a cheap shot, said Eddie Scarry in WashingtonExaminer.com. It makes perfect sense for the nation's leaders to have better access than regular citizens to tests that are in short supply. Their jobs, after all, are slightly more important than most of ours. Complaining that America's top officials get tested more is like griping that Trump gets to fly on Air Force One while the rest of us sit in front of the bathroom at Delta. Yet the mini outbreak in the White House sends an unmistakable message to ordinary voters, said Stephen Collinson in CNN.com. Trump wants to convince Americans that it's safe to come out of lockdown and return to normal life so that he can boost the economy and his reelection chances. But if people around the president can't be protected from this potentially deadly disease in the most highly secured workplace in the country, then how can it be safe for anyone else to go back to work? Our controversy of the week is titled, Flynn, Why Barr Wants to Drop All Charges. Prosecutors and criminal lawyers are hard to really shock, said Neil Katyal and Joshua Geltzer in the New York Times. But when Attorney General William Barr last week moved to drop all charges against General Michael Flynn, President Trump's disgraced former national security advisor, he left the law enforcement community in a state of outrage and utter demoralization. In a legal motion so tortured no career prosecutor would sign their names to it, Barr informed the judge overseeing Flynn's case that even though Flynn twice pleaded guilty to lying to the FBI, his covert contacts with Russia in 2016 were not material to an FBI counterintelligence investigation of the Trump team's covert contacts with Russia. That claim is absurd on its face, said Randall Eliason in the Washington Post. The FBI was probing whether the Trump administration was promising to ease sanctions as a quid pro quo for Russian assistance during the election, a question that remains open. Barr's blatantly partisan intervention in this case has prompted 2,000 former Justice Department officials to sign a letter calling for his resignation, and Judge Emmett Sullivan to take the unusual step of soliciting briefs from outside parties before he rules on Barr's motion to let Flynn walk. Actually, this was the right call by Barr, said James Gagliano in WashingtonExaminer.com. Flynn pleaded guilty in 2017 at the height of the Russiagate hysteria after special counsel Robert Mueller threatened not only him but also his son with a slew of arcane foreign lobbying charges. Since then, there has been disclosure after damning disclosure about the sordid origins of the Russia probe, including handwritten notes by FBI agents scheming to get Flynn to lie so we can prosecute him or get him fired. Yes, Flynn lied, said Dan McLaughlin in NationalReview.com, but everyone knows such cases are often not pursued when the defendant isn't charged with any underlying crime. Flynn's prosecution was a perfect storm of overreach, and Barr made the right judgment. The FBI did make serious mistakes at the outset of the Russia probe, said David Ignatius in the Washington Post. But it was justified in probing why Flynn assured the Kremlin that Trump would review the sanctions the Obama administration had just imposed on Russia for election meddling in Trump's behalf. And why did he try to cover that up? Flynn also lied repeatedly about having taken $500,000 from the Turkish government to further its interest in Washington, said David Graham in TheAtlantic.com. These lies made Flynn vulnerable to blackmail. This rogue actor has no business getting anywhere near the sensitive job of National Security Advisor. Flynn's secrets are Trump's secrets, said David Frum in TheAtlantic.com. He and Trump cronies Roger Stone and Paul Manafort likely know the full story of Trump campaign's many contacts with WikiLeaks, Russian hackers, and Russia. Barr has intervened to shield all three men from the full weight of justice, with the clear goal of keeping Trump's secrets buried as deep as he can for as long as he can. Barr won't stop there, said former FBI agent Frank Figliucci in NBCNews.com. He already is running a criminal investigation into the intelligence officials who launched the Russia probe, and Trump's Obamagate tweets this week signal a sweet switch from defense to offense. President Obama and then Vice President Joe Biden, Trump allies say, attended a meeting where Flynn's call to the Russian ambassador was discussed. To see what's coming next, we don't need a crystal ball. Time for our Good Week, Bad Week segment. Seems it was a good week for whodunits. After a toilet flushed in the background as Supreme Court oral arguments took place via telephone. Slate.com's Ashley Feinberg said her audio analysis points to Justin Stephen Breyer, 81, being the culprit. But there is reasonable doubt. It was a good week for wine tasting. After California man Gabriel Moreno hopped aboard a moving tanker truck loaded with red wine and, positioning himself beneath the tank, unscrewed a valve and let the contents gush forth into his mouth. He was arrested after the trucker noticed he'd lost about 1,000 gallons of wine. It was a good week for air passengers after Frontier Airlines shelved a plan to charge customers $39 extra to sit next to an empty middle seat. It was never our intent to profit from passengers' fear of coronavirus, Frontier CEO Barry Biffle told Congress. But it was a bad week for horticulture after Queen guitarist Brian May, 72, informed his 2.4 million Instagram followers that in a moment of enthusiastic gardening, he had managed to rip my gluteus maximus to shreds. In lieu of mockery, May asked for healing silence from the public while his torn buttocks regenerate, as the pain is relentless. It was a bad week for yin after the Académie Française, the guardian body of the French language, declared that COVID-19 is a feminine noun, requiring the article la, despite a few faulty les in the media. And finally, it was a bad week for ventilation after a now-viral video showed a Kentucky woman approaching a gas station cashier wearing a face mask into which a hole has been cut around the nose and mouth. This makes it a lot easier to breathe, the woman explains. Oh, boy. And before we move on, a short newsy item here. China, Iran hacking virus research, U.S. says. The Trump administration this week accused China of mounting cyber attacks targeting U.S. universities and healthcare companies in an effort to steal research aimed at a COVID-19 treatment or vaccine. The FBI is investigating suspected intrusions at research labs by hackers linked to the Chinese government. Federal agencies warned of insider threats on campuses and at private laboratories, but offered no specific evidence of Chinese intrusions. Trump administration officials also accuse Iran of waging cyber attacks since at least January 3rd against research-related intellectual property. The Wall Street Journal reports, Iran allegedly targeted Gilead Sciences, the American pharmaceutical company whose antiviral drug remdesivir has emerged as a potential treatment. Moving on to the briefing page, we have the infodemic, how the coronavirus sparked a tsunami of misinformation. What's being said? Social media has been awash in lies, rumors, and distortions about the coronavirus, its origins, and potential cures almost since the pandemic start. NewsGuard, a private company that rates websites' reliability, has identified 203 websites throughout the world promoting COVID-19 misinformation. Among the most popular COVID-19 myths were garlic can cure COVID-19. A group funded by Bill Gates patented the coronavirus, and the COVID-19 virus is a man-made bioweapon. The World Health Organization is calling the deluge of misinformation an infodemic, while Google, Facebook, and Twitter are instituting policies to help slow the spread of lies. CEO Mark Zuckerberg's Facebook fact checkers have taken down hundreds of thousands of pieces of misinformation and slapped warnings on 40 million posts during March alone, the company says. Last week, YouTube removed a video titled Plandemic that had been viewed by millions of times, featuring discredited microbiologist and anti-vaxxer Judy Mikovits. In the video and a book that reached number one on Amazon, Mikovits contends the coronavirus was created and spread by a conspiracy of wealthy people and scientists such as Dr. Anthony Fauci, head of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, to bolster vaccine rates and make money. Mikovits has been claiming her career was destroyed by Fauci and other scientists since she falsely reported in a 2009 study, later retracted by the journal that published it, that a retrovirus caused chronic fatigue syndrome. What's the motive? For some, profit. For others, attention. Conspiracy theorist Alex Jones and his InfoWars website have warned their audience that the coronavirus is a man-made tool to winnow the world's population. InfoWars was ordered by the FDA and FTC last month to stop peddling products such as Super Silver Whitening Toothpaste and Super Blue Silver Immune Gargle that Jones portrayed as coronavirus cures and prophylactics. He and many other websites popular on Facebook are hawking colloidal silver as a cure for coronavirus. Taken in large doses, it turns your skin blue. The idea that there is a magical treatment has been promoted by President Trump, who suggested that UV light and disinfectant could be used to kill the virus inside the lungs, almost like a cleaning. He also spent weeks promoting an anti-malaria drug, hydrochloroquine, as one of the biggest game changers in the history of medicine. That led to a huge spike in sales of the drug and to state governments stockpiling 30 million doses of it. Several studies have subsequently found that hydrochloroquine has no benefit for COVID-19 patients and can cause life-threatening heart arrhythmias. Why so much disinformation? Stanford University professor Robert N. Proctor says humanity has always been susceptible to misinformation during a time of great fear, from the burning of witches on up to hydrochloroquine. Conspiracy theories, he says, make powerless people feel they have some inside knowledge and thus some control over frightening events. Misinformation also spread easily during prior health scares, including the Spanish flu outbreak of 1918, the AIDS epidemic, and the SARS in 2003. The fact that so little is known about the coronavirus also fuels the lies and rumors. It's frustrating when responsible media say, look, we don't know the answers yet, said Carl T. Bergstrom, an evolutionary biologist at the University of Washington who studies misinformation. What are state actors doing? The State Department has warned that Iran, China, and Russia are using coronavirus propaganda to damage the U.S. and distract their own populations from their poor official response. A Russian state TV network, for example, falsely reported that the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation created the coronavirus in conjunction with pharmaceutical companies to profit off therapies. Both Russian and Iranian state sources have claimed the virus is a U.S.-created bioweapon, and the state-run China Global Television Network says the pandemic was started by Americans who went to Wuhan, China, for a military athletic competition in October. What's the 5G theory? One of the most popular conspiracy theory holds that the pandemic was actually caused by radio waves from the new mobile technology, noting that it was deployed in Wuhan shortly before the outbreak. In Britain, arsonists torched at least 20 cell phone towers, and engineers have been harassed. In one clip viewed more than 2 million times, a British woman asks telecom engineers why they are laying what she believes to be the 5G cables, saying the cables are going to kill everyone. In her video, book, and tweets, Mikovits promotes even more bizarre ideas, including that sheltering in place, washing your hands, and wearing a mask can increase your likelihood of getting COVID-19. These protective measures, she said, are literally killing people. In the scientific community, Mikovits is known as a quack who was fired from a research institute and arrested for stealing equipment. But in the social media era, said Renee DiResta, who studies disinformation at the Stanford Internet Observatory, what millions of people believe is essentially determined by whoever runs the best marketing campaign. Read a few of the best columns of the week. This one comes from Michael Steinbrenner at TheAtlantic.com. It's titled Accepting Incompetence as Normal. During the Monica Lewinsky scandal, 30 U.S. newspapers urged President Bill Clinton to resign, said Michael Steinberger. President Richard Nixon faced widespread calls for his resignation for months before he finally gave in. With 84,000 Americans dead in just 2 months from a virus, President Trump kept insisting that would just go away, and the economy collapsing, why aren't there newspaper editorials and major political figures clamoring for him to resign and leave the leadership of the country in more competent hands? Americans seem to have developed a high tolerance for failure. Indeed, a weary expectation that political and business leaders will make catastrophic errors. In recent years, we've endured 9/11, the Iraq War, the 2008 financial meltdown, the Boeing 737 MAX debacle, and Russian election interference. Trump's epic mishandling of the coronavirus pandemic has been even more costly, with far higher death tolls than any other nation by far, and no end in sight. But his shamelessness, his unwillingness to express contrition, seems to have become kind of a shield. He brazenly insists he has no responsibility at all, and people just wince. The silence is yet another indication of how warped our politics has become. This is from the United Kingdom. How we failed our elderly. COVID-19 is tearing through our nursing homes, said Richard Coker, a professor of public health at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. At least 32,000 Britons have died from the disease, and preliminary figures suggest that in England and Wales, one-third of fatalities are now occurring in nursing facilities. Once all deaths have been reported, I predict that we'll see how care homes have taken the full force of this epidemiological tsunami. It didn't have to be this way. The original pursuit of herd immunity to the virus a strategy that was pursued and then abandoned by Prime Minister Boris Johnson's government, was supposed to include protections for nursing homes. Had the government adequately supplied facilities with medical masks and gloves, tested residents, and barred outsiders from visiting, thousands of lives could have been saved. But this is not what happened. Instead, care homes took the brunt of the virus. We have a term in epidemiology for the extra deaths of old and sick that occur in a natural disaster. Harvesting. That word also has darker connotations, those of sacrifice, reaping, culling. Harvesting is a side effect of catastrophes, but it is not supposed to be a policy goal. It looks horrifyingly as though, in this case, the government pursued harvesting just without telling us. Our most vulnerable citizens were sacrificed. This column comes from India. Take advantage of the flight from China. India could emerge from the pandemic as an economic winner, said Sitaram Sharma. In the short term, of course, there will be pain. Experts predict that up to 400 million Indians working in the shadow economy could sink further into poverty as economic growth shrinks to zero. But in the longer term, global supply lines are sure to shift as nations become more protectionist and less inclined to trust their manufacturing to China. There is now worldwide rage against China over its attempts to conceal the true nature of the coronavirus outbreak in Wuhan, including that the deadly disease could be transmitted from human to human. The U.S. in particular is eager both to blame China and to punish it. The Trump administration is now actively pushing U.S. companies to move production away from China to friendlier nations. India, with its vast pool of workers, including talented engineers who are willing to work for half the pay of Chinese labor, is a viable alternative. If India starts aggressively marketing itself now, it can become the next great global manufacturing hub. Already, industry groups are predicting that the Indian phone manufacturing sector could grow from $25 billion today to $400 billion by 2024. In crisis lies the opportunity. And we all go right on over to the last word, our in-depth article, titled this week, "You're Going to Have to Push Them." As workers fell ill at an Iowa meat plant, the company and the White House had one priority, said Anna Swanson, David Yef Bellany, and Michael Corkery in the New York Times, keeping the conveyor belt running. On April 10th, Tony Thompson, the sheriff for Black Hawk County in Iowa, visited the giant Tyson Foods pork plant in Waterloo. What he saw, he said, shook me to the core. Workers, many of them immigrants, were crowded elbow to elbow as they broke down hog carcasses zipping by on a conveyor belt. The few who had face coverings were a motley assortment of bandanas, painter's masks, or even sleep masks stretched around their mouths. Some had masks hanging around their necks. Thompson and other local officials lobbied Tyson to close the plant, worried about a coronavirus outbreak. In an April 14th phone call, county health officials asked Tyson to shut down temporarily. But Tyson was less than cooperative, said the sheriff, who supervises the county's coronavirus response. An Iowa governor declined to shut the facility. Waterloo Tyson is running, the company said in a text message to employees April 17th. Thank you, team members. We are proud of you. 5 days later, the plant was closed. Tyson said the reason was worker absenteeism, as well as a spike in cases and community concerns. By early May, the county health department had recorded 1,031 coronavirus infections among Tyson employees, more than one-third of the workforce. Some are on ventilators. At least three have died. The plant didn't stay closed for long. As meat shortages hit grocery stores and fast food restaurants, political pressure built to get dozens of plants across the country that had shut down because of the virus outbreaks up and running again. After an executive order by President Donald Trump declared the meat supply critical infrastructure and shielded the companies from certain liability, Tyson reopened its Waterloo facility last week. New safety precautions have been added, such as plexiglass barriers along the production line, infrared temperature scanners to detect fevers, and face shields and masks for the workers. Now the question is, will America's appetite for meat be sated without sickening low-wage workers and their communities in new waves of infection? Workers and their advocates say Tyson's actions and recent federal safety guidelines have come far too late. They point to lapses that Tyson made in the first 3 weeks of April as the virus tore largely unimpeded through the Waterloo plant. As high-level executives lobbied the White House to help protect Tyson from the lawsuits, the company was failing to provide adequate safety equipment to Waterloo workers and refusing the request of local officials to close the plant, according to more than two dozen interviews with plant employees, immigrant rights activists, advocates, doctors, lawyers, and government officials. While Tyson began changing its policies on short-term disability benefits in late March to encourage sick workers to stay home, many employees were not certain of the rules, and some went to work sick to avoid losing pay. Rumors and misinformation spread among the workers, many of whom are not native English speakers. As the workforce dwindled, fear gripped the plant. Steve Stouffer, head of Tyson's beef and pork operations, says the company had made the best safety decisions it could in a rapidly evolving situation. But he acknowledged that the company might have done more. Looking at it in the rearview mirror, you can always be better, he said. Thompson said that he was thankful for the new safety precautions, but that Tyson had been too slow to act. Which is more important, he asked, your pork chops or the people who are contracting COVID, the people that are dying from it? A squat gray building branded with the slogan, A Cut Above the Rest, the Waterloo plant is Tyson's largest pork operation in the United States, responsible for almost 4% of the nation's pork supply. Before the pandemic, it operated around the clock, breaking down up to 19,500 hogs a day into cuts of meat that traveled on a fleet of trucks across the country. It is tough, demanding work, usually performed by workers standing close together. During a conference call on March 9th, union leaders in the meat industry discussed how to spread out workers in plants and take other precautions. But at the time, the problem seemed a long way from eastern Iowa, said Bob Waters, president of the local union for the Waterloo plant. We thought it might come, but we hoped it didn't, he said. Iowa, like several other Midwestern states, never issued a statewide stay-at-home order. By early April, however, the Black Hawk County Emergency Operations Center had started getting complaints about dangerous conditions at the plant. Workers and their relatives reported a lack of protective gear and insufficient safety protocols and said employees were starting to test positive for the virus. Tyson had put some precautions in place. In March, it began checking workers for fevers as they entered the plant and relaxed its policy so workers who tested positive or were feeling unwell would be paid a portion of their salary even if they stayed home. But workers were still crowded together on the factory floor, in the cafeteria, and in the locker room, and most did not wear masks. Tyson said it offered cloth bandanas to workers who asked, but by the time it tried to buy protective gear, supplies were scarce. At least one employee vomited while working on the production line, and several left the facility with soaring temperatures, according to a worker who spoke on the condition of anonymity for fear of losing his job, and local advocates who have spoken with the workers at the plant. Because of patient privacy laws, Tyson and the union had difficulty obtaining information from state officials about which workers had tested positive, hampering their efforts to isolate colleagues in close contact with them. Older employees, as well as those with asthma or diabetes, became increasingly afraid to enter the plant. It was really a time of fear and panic, said State Representative Timmy Brown Powers, who works at a coronavirus clinic at Waterloo. They had not slowed down the line. They were not practicing any sort of social distancing. Workers at the plant were confused about why so many colleagues seemed to be getting sick and missing work. Supervisors told them that it was the flu, some said, or warned them not to talk about the virus. In an emailed statement, Tyson said it had worked with the information available to us at the time to help keep our team members safe. The company said earlier information from the Black Hawk County Health Department would have helped its decision-making. Dr. Nafisa Sisi Ebuguni, director of the Black Hawk County Health Department, said that before the state changed the rules on April 14th to help speed public health investigations, she was legally prevented from sharing the names of employees who had tested positive with the company. But she said that she had been in constant communication with the plant and had shared her concerns. I think they had enough information, she said, to take the necessary measures. Iowa, an overwhelmingly white state, has long had a complicated relationship with meatpacking plants. While the industry is an engine of the state's economy and the country's food supply, it also employs many immigrants who have faced periodic raids to enforce immigration laws. Even with union representation, immigrants at the plant say they are afraid to raise concerns about working conditions. The narrative is shifting the blame to the workers instead of focusing on the true incompetence, in my opinion, of the government. Not just the governor, but also leaders here at Tyson, said Nelvia Reyes Rodriguez, president of the Waterloo chapter of the League of United Latin American Citizens. It was their responsibility to protect their workers. She added, because of the population in those industries, I think there is disregard for those communities. Tyson said in a statement that it took pride in its diversity and that its immigrant workers have advanced to management positions, including at the Waterloo plant. But some of these tensions simmered as local politicians became locked in a struggle with the state and then the federal government over closing the plant. After Thompson's visit, he and other local politicians began lobbying Tyson and Governor Kim Reynolds for a shutdown. The governor sided with Tyson. She issued an executive order on April 16th, stating that only the state government, not local governments, had the authority to close businesses in northeast Iowa, including the Waterloo plant. We're making sure the workforce is protected and, most importantly, that we're keeping the food supply chain moving, Reynolds said. The number of infections continued to increase. Tyson said it began winding down operations April 20th. But the plant did not fully shut down until April 22nd, after the company had processed the remaining hog carcasses in its cooler. After the plant closed, the company invited workers back for coronavirus testing. But that process may have infected more workers, said Christine Kemp, chief executive of a local health clinic. Employees bunched together outside the plant and crowded the stairwells. Some left without being tested, afraid they would catch the virus in line. The virus had already spread through the community, including to a nursing home where several workers are married to Tyson employees. The Tyson employees who have died include a Bosnian refugee, survived by a grieving husband, and a man with three daughters. The mother died from cancer last year, and the oldest daughter, 19, will take guardianship of her sisters. The political stakes of the reopening in Waterloo are high. With meat supplies disrupted, the White House has pushed Tyson and other meat companies to continue operating. And Tyson officials had plenty of chances to air concerns, dining at the White House and participating in several calls with the president and vice president in recent months. Since he issued the executive order on April 28th, Trump has been quick to declare that the supply chain is back on track. Asked Wednesday about a hamburger shortage at Wendy's, he turned to the Secretary of Agriculture, Sonny Perdue. Basically, you're saying in a week and a half, you think everything is going to be good, or sooner, the president asked. Yes, these plants are opening as we speak, Perdue said. You're going to have to push them, the president replied. Push them more. But the reopening may have to proceed in fits and starts. The Waterloo plant restarted last week at about 50% of capacity. Ramping back up could take weeks as workers return from quarantine. Stouffer, the Tyson executive, said he hoped the worst was over. But health officials warn that a rush to full production could cause a second wave of infections. History will be the judge eventually, Stouffer said. But we have attempted very hard, our entire team, our entire organization, from the chairman of the board on down, to do the right thing. This article was originally published in the New York Times. We'll read a couple of the health and science articles this week, starting with, will reopening schools extend the pandemic? Two new studies suggest that although children are less vulnerable to COVID-19, they may be more able to transmit the coronavirus than previously thought. The research, which hasn't been peer-reviewed, adds fuel to the debate over whether reopening schools could prolong the pandemic by allowing more community transmissions. The first study, conducted in the Chinese cities of Wuhan and Shanghai, found that kids were about a third as susceptible to infection as adults, but that this advantage was essentially canceled when they returned to school, where they had three times as many contacts as adults, and so three times as many opportunities to catch the disease. The second study, by German researchers, found that children who tested positive for COVID-19 carried at least the same viral load as adults. Moreover, the level of symptoms appeared to have no bearing on viral loads. Asymptomatic children carried just as much of the virus, and sometimes more, as kids and adults showing symptoms. The science is far from settled. Previous research that concluded children are less likely to transmit the virus than adults is part of the reason Denmark, Germany, and other countries have started reopening schools. Adam Finn, head of World Health Organization Advisory Group on Immunization, says more research on transmission rates is needed. All we really know, he tells Bloomberg.com, is that with a small number of exceptions, children are mildly affected by this infection. Invasion of the murder hornets. Be careful when you next head outside because the murder hornet has arrived in America. The largest member of the wasp family, queens grow up to 2 inches long, Asian giant hornets are known for invading honeybee hives, decapitating all the inhabitants in a matter of hours with their mandibles, and then flying away with the thoraxes to feed their young. The insect stinger, which can penetrate beekeeping suits, delivers an excruciating venom that in multiple doses can send a person into anaphylactic shock. In Japan, Asian giant hornets kill up to 50 people a year. Now, for the first time, these fearsome insects have been spotted in the U.S., reports the New York Times. Washington state officials say they have verified 4 sightings of Asian giant hornets from December. The hornets have been also spotted across the border in British Columbia. Scientists are desperately trying to hunt down and destroy their nests, which can hold up to 1,000 hornets and their larvae, before the index become rooted in the U.S. This is our window, said Chris Looney from the Washington State Department of Agriculture. If we can't do it in the next couple of years, it probably can't be done. And we'll move right over to the Talking Points page, starting with the article child care. No reopening without it. Policymakers don't get it, said Emily Peck in HuffingtonPost.com. You can't reopen the economy without solving the issue of child care. 50% of daycare centers were shut down as of April, and another 17% were open only to the kids of essential workers, such as cops and supermarket clerks. Schools in 43 states are closed until at least the fall, and summer camps are going to be either closed or breeding grounds for infections. While children rarely get sick as a result of contracting coronavirus, research indicates they can spread it to others. In a pre-pandemic world, grandparents might step in, but for people over 70, the coronavirus poses a high risk of serious illness and death. 50 million American workers have kids under the age of 18 and 25 million under 6. These people are stuck. The consequences of this child care crisis are going to fall primarily on women, said Ellie Mistel at inthenation.com. Even though women constitute roughly half of America's workforce, they still shoulder the majority of child care, house cleaning, and food preparation. Already, a poll found 14% of women were thinking about quitting their jobs. Some legal experts are bracing for lawsuits from parents told to physically return to work, even though they have no child care, or those who seek flex time or other child care arrangements, said Jenna McGregor in the Washington Post. The Families First Coronavirus Response Act, passed in March, guaranteed 12 weeks of expanded family medical and sick leave at two-thirds pay for workers at smaller businesses until the end of 2020. But some employers haven't adapted to the new law, and working parents have been denied leave or punished for requesting it. For the estimated 10 million single parents in this country, the options are especially slim, said Lauren Weber and Rachel Feinzeig in the Wall Street Journal. Take Ingrid Johnson, a sheet metal worker in Pascagoula, Mississippi. She used to drop off her sons, ages 7 and 8, at a daycare center that later took them to school by van. The center is closed, and so is the school, so she's resorted to having her 12-year-old niece stay with her kids. She's not the age I would like her to be, Johnson said, but it's the best option I have left. Shutdowns, the Dallas Hair Salon Rebellion. A Dallas beauty salon has become the latest front in the culture war, said Dan Solomon in TexasMonthly.com. Owner Shelley Luther became pivotal in the stay-at-home order debates when she opened her salon in defiance of a state shutdown and then was jailed for defying a court order to close. I couldn't feed my family, and my stylist couldn't feed their family, she told a judge. Sentenced to 7 days, Luther became a national folk hero for conservative activists who insist that shutdowns impinge on their liberty. Republican officials rallied to her cause, including Senator Ted Cruz, who flew in for a haircut. Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, who paid her $7,000 fine and volunteered to serve the time himself. And Governor Greg Abbott, who termed Luther's jailing for violating his own executive order nonsensical, and called for Luther's release, which was granted by the state Supreme Court after 48 hours. Who cannot have sympathy for this Texas mom, said William McGurn in the Wall Street Journal. Nobody denies that she broke the executive order, but when an otherwise hardworking, law-abiding American lands in the pokey for trying to work, it ought to raise questions beyond the letter of the law. Luther offers an example of what can happen when good people suddenly deprived of the ability to provide for their families feel they have no choice. Americans need to make a living, said Kaylee McGee in WashingtonExaminer.com. Hospitals aren't overwhelmed, and as people like Luther struggle, it is becoming more and more difficult to justify prolonging a lockdown that seems to have served its purpose. It was all a show, said Bud Kennedy in the Fort Worth Star-Telegram. 2 days before the court hearing where she pleaded poverty, Luther had been approved for an $18,000 federal paycheck protection loan. The Republican Party's Tea Party Liberty faction stage managed the whole thing and raised more than $500,000 for Luther through a GoFundMe campaign. All in all, it was a disgraceful spectacle, said an editorial in the Waco Tribune Herald. The 7-day jail sentence may have been too harsh, but should a court simply ignore open defiance of a public safety law? Chalk it all up to a nation gone mad, where governors undermine their own authority in the name of political expediency, and a president looks on approvingly. We'll pick one of the short notes here for you. With gun sales soaring during the pandemic, unintentional shootings by kids under the age 17 claimed 21 lives in March and April. Most of the killings came when kids found their parents' guns and played with them. And we'll close with a quote from Ralph Waldo Emerson, who says, "Adopt the pace of nature. Her secret is patience." And with that, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call. That number is 919-832-5138.